The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to the City Bible Forum. My name is Peter Caldor, if we haven't met before, and a special welcome if you're here for the first time. Today we're up to the third talk in our eight-part series on the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, and we're looking today at the theme of Money Doesn't Bring Happiness and Other Urban Myths. Our speaker is Al Stewart. Al is the speaker for this series. And if you've got any comments or questions, we really do welcome those. Please take the time to jot those down on the little slips of paper inside your program. We'll collect them, and then Al will do his best to respond. Okay, you may wish to follow along as I read, and you listen. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days his work is pain and grief, yet at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless.
Thanks, Peter. Well, good afternoon. Now that was enthusiasm. We'll try it again. Okay, ready? Good afternoon. Ah, well done. Okay, I know, Thursday lunchtime, we're almost at the weekend. Let me begin with one of my favourite stories about Big Arnie Schwarzenegger. I saw this before Arnie became the governator. Arnie was on Oprah Winfrey. Now, I can't remember why I was watching Oprah in the middle of the day, but I'm sure there was a really good reason. Anyway, she was interviewing the big guy and fawning all over him about how famous he was and how much money he had and how successful he'd been and so on. And as they're talking about that, Arnie looks at her and says, "Oprah, I have to tell you that I have found money doesn't bring happiness. I now have $50 million, and I am no happier than when I had $48 million. And they all laughed. I thought, yep, he's nailed it. So what's the big guy saying? He's making fun of the fact that we say, oh, money can't bring happiness, but no one believes that. Really, even when I say it, money doesn't bring happiness, there's a little voice in the back of my head that says, yeah, but I'd love a truckload to find out for myself. So it doesn't matter who says it, we don't believe it. Someone who's poor says it, and we say, well, of course they'd say it, they haven't got any money. Or someone who's rich says it, and you think, yeah, well, it's easy for them to say. I'd like the money to find out for myself. Money is exciting, it's sexy, it gives security and power and significance. Money sells. I don't know if you've ever noticed, Business Review Weekly, BRW, puts out each year the Rich 200 list. This is a couple of years old, this one, because I'm a cheapskate, but it sells. And the richest 200 people in Australia, they don't put out the poor 2 million. That's not exciting, but the rich 200, oh yeah. And money is exciting and sexy and so on. And you know what? Money's very personal as well. And the reason I know that is, for years I worked as a pastor of a church, and I'd meet mainly with the men of the congregation. I'd talk to them about how they're going. And as a pastor, it's really easy to talk to a man about how his marriage is, his sex life, his kids, work, any of that. But the area where you have to be really, really careful, it's almost a total no-go zone, is how much money do you earn? You can't... you have to be very careful. And we live in a world... Our society has pretty much devoted itself to making money. And the idea, if we just have more, then we'll be happier and money finally delivers and it's all about what I own and so on. But the question is, does money really deliver? Does it really work, or does it fade away? Does it deliver as it promises? What I'd like to do is look with you today at the words written by one of the richest men who ever lived, King Solomon, who was king in Israel around about 950 BC, just after the great King David. Solomon was the richest king in ancient Israel, rich and famous and had all the money you could ever possibly need. And he has written the book of Ecclesiastes. But Solomon, or possibly a later writer through Solomon's eyes. And he's written the book of Ecclesiastes looking for what is it in life that lasts? What has meaning and purpose, and what's what has substance, and what doesn't just fade away? And he looks today at the topic of money and possessions and so on. So I thought I'd show you today a whole list of reasons or what Solomon says about this. But let me introduce you, just in case you haven't been here the last few weeks. It's not hard to get up to speed. I'll show you on the screen. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2, he says the way that the world looks. So he begins chapter 1, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. The meaningless word is the New International Version, the English translation, trying to translate a Hebrew word, the Hebrew word hebel, which means literally a mist or a breath or a vapour, something that's kind of there and then it's gone. It's transient, it's fleeting. And they're trying to come to terms with that. Meaningless is a good translation. The older Bibles would go for, the King James Bible went for vanity, in the sense that it's all in vain. It's the idea of it all slips away, it all disappears. And he's saying that's what life looks like. It just kind of, it's transient, it's fleeting, it's so short, it's gone before you know it. And he's asking a question about what has real value. You see chapter 1, verse 3, it'll be on the screen. He says, what does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? What does man, people, humanity, what do we gain? The word gain is a commercial term. It's like, what's the bottom line? What's the take-home value, the dividend? What's left at the end of the day? What has lasting value after all our labour? Notice the little phrase, under the sun. What does he mean by that? As far as I can work out, that phrase happens almost 30 times in this little book. Under the sun means if all we had was our common sense, our eyes and ears open, and we look out at the world, what do we see? He's not an atheist, by no means. But if God hadn't spoken to us, if God hadn't intervened in our world and spoken, how would we make sense of things? Intuitively, he knows God's there, just as the vast majority of people believe in God, saying, yeah, God's there, but how would we make sense of life if we just kind of looked at it under the sun? It's now our third week on working through Ecclesiastes. And if you're new here, you could easily catch up. We've only done a couple of chapters. We'll speed up in the coming weeks. But what we saw is, after he says it all seems meaningless, in chapter one he looks at the way our world is. And that was a happy day, because we saw the world goes on in kind of endless cycles, and compared to the world, we're only here 5 minutes, and we're bored while we are here, and no one will remember us anyway. And then he thinks, well, no, wait a minute, I'm a wise man, I've got all the money in the world, lots of time, there must be something that I can find that has real, lasting substance, something that isn't a mist or a vapour. And so in chapter 2, week 2, we saw he looks at pleasure. You know, pleasure must be good. He says, yes, it's good, but it doesn't last. It's like splashing your face with water. It's nice, but then it's gone. And you can't hold on to pleasure. You can't put it in a box and seal it up and hang on to it. He says, well, if not pleasure, then maybe wisdom. Yes, wisdom's good as well, and it helps you live your life, but it comes to a dead end because everyone's learning gets buried with them. And so chapter 3, he says, well, what about work and possessions and wealth and so on? Now, you notice on your outline I put in two chunks of Ecclesiastes from chapter 2 and chapter 5. I've done that because he comes to this theme twice in the book. I thought we'd do it both today. Chapter 2 is the idea of finding meaning in our work or our achievements, being successful. Chapter 5, he looks more at the idea of possessions and owning things. So put simply, chapter 2 tends to be more about our work, chapter 5 more about our possessions. But let me now give you 9 reasons why he says money and possessions are fleeting. Why they're hebel, why they're a mist or a vapour, why they don't ultimately deliver. And we'll see if you're convinced at the end. Chapter 2, verse 18. It'll be in your hand, it'll be on the screen. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun. Notice, under the sun, you just look out. I hated all the things I'd worked for under the sun. Why? First reason, he says, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. All the hard work, all the things you've done, it'll all go to someone else. Kathy and I are renting a house at the moment, a nice little house in Maroubra, and we found out last night that the old man who owned our house and had gone to an old folks home and someone else was renting his house out on his behalf, that he had died. All the work, you could see the garden, all the work that he'd done, all those, he's died, someone else gets it. We're paying rent to the someone else at the moment. It's going to happen. Verse 19, he says, and who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. Not only will you leave it to someone else, but that someone else might be an idiot. My guess is, I think Solomon wrote this as an old man, and so he's sitting there, maybe he's writing it himself, maybe he's dictating it to a secretary. My guess is he's kind of looked out the window and seen his son, Rehoboam, you know, out in the yard chasing pigeons or whatever it was he's doing. Because Rehoboam was no rocket scientist, and I think Solomon knew it. As Solomon died after reigning for 40-odd years, he'd left Israel incredibly wealthy and really organised and administratively together and so on, and a big empire. And Rehoboam managed to destroy the empire, divide the nation, set the seeds for civil war and the loss of the empire, the nation and everything. And it took him 3 days. You can read the story in Kings in the book, in the other part of the Old Testament. 3 days. I think Solomon probably shook his head and kept going. Who's going to get all the stuff that you're accumulating, by the way? Who will get all of that? Because someone else is going to have it. The second reason is a little bit like the first, and I'll do it really quickly. He says, verse 20, the second reason, so my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge and skill, like work really, really hard, he says, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. All that we accumulate, not only do you have to give it to someone else, not only maybe they're an idiot, but they haven't worked for it. That's the whole point of an inheritance. You don't work for it, you get given an inheritance. Although it's interesting, the baby boomers have worked that out, I think, and that's why they're busy skinning their kids. Do they skin your kids? Spend kids' inheritance now. Kathy and I went to the Kimberleys in July last year, and in the great outback, you can't get a parking spot. Why? Every grey nomad on the planet is up there with a brand new four-wheel drive and a caravan with a satellite television, spending their kids' inheritance as quickly as they can. Anyway, okay, third reason, verse 22. What does man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. This is a mist, a vapour, you can't hold on to it. You work all day and you've got your guts in a knot and you're uptight and then you come home and you can't sleep properly and you recount the day and you worry. Now, here's where I fess up. I'm the world's worst sleeper. I am. I got to sleep okay, but like 4 o'clock in the morning, bing, I'm awake. And I'm thinking, it's not that I'm worried so much, but I'm thinking, man, there's so much to do. I can't. And then I think, no, must go back to sleep, concentrate. Go. And then I get up, make a cup of coffee, find something to do. Now, you'll get it, won't you, if you can't? It's what he's saying. You can work all day and then you wound up at night. Can't switch off. Here's the thing to notice. Solomon's not a misery guts. He's not asking us to be miserable. In fact, look at verses 24 and 25. What's he say? What's the best you can do under the sun? A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? So if you can eat and drink and enjoy your work, and if you can do that, it's a gift of God. So enjoy life if you can. Verse 26 is a little bit tricky. I'll try and explain it. If I lose you, don't worry, we're back. It gets simple again in about 1 minute. Verse 26. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, He gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The difficulty revolves around the word translated sinner there, which actually means one who is offensive, one who offends God, or one that like God's not happy with. And you read what the scholars say about this. Some of them will say, oh, it's easy. It's divided into those who do the right thing and please God, like the righteous. God gives them knowledge and happiness and so on. But those who do the wrong thing, the sinners, well, they don't get to enjoy their wealth. They just accumulate it and give it to someone else. But the trouble is, if it's a good and bad thing, why is it meaningless and chasing after the wind? There's others who say, no, it's that God's ways seem arbitrary. God gives one person the ability to enjoy their wealth. And God doesn't give that ability to someone else. And what do? They just accumulate it, can't enjoy it, and end up giving it to someone else. And it seems arbitrary. Like, it seems kind of random. Why does this guy get it, or this girl get it, and this girl not? Or so it's random. And they're saying, yeah, it seems kind of meaningless. Okay, so quick summary in chapter 2. What's he saying? You work really hard, but guess what? You'll leave it all to someone else, and they might be an idiot. Secondly, it's leaving it all to someone who hasn't worked for it, and you can get so caught up in it, you can't leave it at work. You replay it all at night. But some people get to enjoy their wealth. Okay, let's go to chapter 5. Chapter 5 is more to do with the perspective of possessions and stuff that we own. So see 5 verse 10. He says, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. Every now and then this is played out. If you love money, it's never enough. Every now and then this is played out kind of on the big stage. It's like there's someone's career is like a kind of shooting star as they flame out on the way down. And it's happened. I'm sure you remember these particular people. So Alan Bond, Christopher Skase, Nick Leeson, big Barings Bank thing in 95, Bernie Ebbers from WorldCom, Ray Williams and HIH, Rene Rivkin, famous stockbroker, and of course the latest really big one, or the biggest of them all really, is Bernie Madoff. What do they have in common? They're guys who started off with lots of money, and yet it just wasn't ever quite enough, because once money starts getting linked in with status and reputation and winning the game, it's never enough, is it? And though they just pushed the edges until it was too late, and then you can never go back. See verse 10, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. As a nation, it's true for us, isn't it? We are, let's check the stats, 3 times wealthier than we were in the 1950s. In real terms, 3 times more money. We're 7 times wealthier than we were 100 years ago. And yet it's not enough, is it? The health system needs fixing, and the roads aren't wide enough, and there's people living in poverty and so on. Why is it that it's never enough as a nation or as individuals? I saw an article written by Marcus Padley, who's a stockbroker, and it's a good little article, a good little explanation of why. He says, financial happiness is relative and it is fleeting. Financial happiness is achieved by improving your standard of living relative to your current standard of living and relative to the standard of living of your peers. You see, you rate yourself not beside Bill Gates, but beside your peer group. But unfortunately, when you achieve happiness through a lift in your standard of living, you quickly adapt. You lift your sights. Your newfound position quickly becomes the new norm. The happiness fades. What this means is that no manner of improvement in standard of living will create long-term happiness. The tragic personal lives of some of the very rich is a testament to this fact. Standards of living have improved enormously over the last 30 years, but the level of happiness has not. But all is not lost. Following the theory through, you should realise that the promise or expectation of a future lift in your standard of living will make you happier than an actual lift in your standard of living. In other words, hope is more important than money. So What that means is when your boss offers you a pay rise, say, look, no, I don't want it. I just want to actually look forward to it. Okay? None of that works, does it? So money won't make you happy, but looking forward to having money will. It's funny, isn't it? It's just never enough. Fifth reason, verse 11. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? One thing that struck me when Michael Jackson died several months ago now, as I read Time magazine about him, was the number of hangers-on and parasites that had attached themselves to him. And the richer he got and so on, the more he got, the more people he had kind of bleeding him of money and wealth and so on. And it happens to those who become wealthy. And see what he says, the more stuff you get, all you can do is actually look at it. I remember my brother explaining to my father about my brother's business partner. And Mark said to Dad, and Dad, my partner, like, there's just him and his wife, and he'd bought this really nice house on the Lower North Shore in Sydney. And what he'd done is he took the roof off and he put an extra story on. He moved all the bedrooms upstairs. And downstairs is just like this massive entertaining area. And it's so beautiful. We walked into his lounge room and Helen and I looked around and Dad, we counted 16 lounge chairs. 16 in the one room. My dad said, 16 lounge chairs, eh? But he's only got one bum. And that's true, isn't it? We'll only ever have one bum. Sixth reason, the sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. What's he saying? I think the labourer, the hard worker, sleeps well because he or she's tired. The abundance of the rich man, it's hard to know, does he mean the rich man, because of his wealth, worries about his wealth? So, for example, the people who worry about the stock market are those who own shares. Or does he mean the abundance in terms of rich food? So the rich man is feasting all night and so can't sleep because his belly's upset. Not sure, maybe both is meant. Verse 13, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or perhaps salary caps rorted to the harm of their owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him, so whole financial empires can disappear and some it slips through the fingers. Now, that's six reasons, and they're okay. We've whipped through them. The seventh one really has teeth. Do you see the seventh one? Verse 15. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This, too, is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain since he toils for the wind? In the BRW Rich List, the 200 richest people, in the back they have an obituary section, and that is for people who have died, were on the list last year but have since died. So in this particular year there was a transport magnate from South Australia, manufacturing billionaire from Melbourne, a property developer from Sydney, and so on. There's about a dozen people. And they list a little obituary about them and what they did, and then the last thing they do is they list the total amount of wealth that they left behind. And I was really surprised. There's a dozen people in here, but when they come to list what they left behind, the number is always the same. Everything. Everything. They died empty-handed. I have a mate who's, for a few months, has been working as an undertaker. He actually likes it. He gets to dress like one of the men in black. He drives a big black limo, and actually what he does is he helps people when they're hurting. He's good. He's good at that. And he assures me that there are no luggage racks on a hearse. There's never a luggage problem at a funeral. See verse 16. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain since he toils for the wind? We're born empty-handed, and we die empty-handed. I remember leaving home as an 18-year-old with two suitcases and a cardboard box. It was everything I owned in the world. Last time we moved house, it was two Pantech trucks. But I'll make another move in a few years where I'll take less than two suitcases in a cardboard box. And so will you. And if we get caught up with thinking that money and wealth, and if we can just have more, and if that's it, see what happens in verse 17? All his days he eats in darkness and great frustration, affliction and anger. It's a miserable business if you get caught up that way. But what does he say? Once again, he's saying, look, the eighth reason in verse 18 is actually positive. He's saying, instead of trying to own the world, why not enjoy it instead? Instead of owning it, let's enjoy it. Verse 18. Then I realised that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him. For this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. So what's he saying? If you can enjoy your life, your work, if you can eat and drink, do it. Enjoy it. And when you look at it, what he's actually kind of saying is, if God's given you the ability to enjoy life, do it. And as you're enjoying life, you won't be filled with kind of this great existential angst. Well, sometimes you will be. Seldom reflects on the days of his life. It's almost as if he's saying pleasure is a bit of an anesthetic. Although I think as Solomon writes this, he still wants the answers. He can't just drift off into chasing pleasure. Enjoy it if you can. Enjoy it if you can. Well, there's eight reasons. Convinced? It's so hard to believe it, isn't it? Money can't buy happiness. No one believes that. It just, everything, the whole world just seems to go the other direction. We're in a world that's so driven, more and more wealth and so on, even at great personal cost. You know the expression, selling your soul? And that is, you know, what you want, and we'll actually sell our soul to do it. I think that actually comes from Jesus, as Jesus speaks to us and warns us. Jesus speaks a lot about money. Let me just leave Ecclesiastes for a moment and just show you one of the things that Jesus says about wealth. He talks about money more than almost any other subject. Why? Because money was as powerful and seductive in the first century as it is in the 21st century. Look at what Jesus says in Mark chapter 8 about kind of selling your soul. He says, "What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul?" What does he mean? He's saying if you spend your whole life chasing money and so on, no matter how successful you are, if you've been ignoring God, it's a bad deal. Because you'll lose your life or soul. You can translate it either way. You'll lose your soul, your life in eternity. I wanted to show you the ninth reason with nine names, actually. Nine names. Does anyone recognise those nine names? They've been in the news a lot, actually, in the last 4 years, 5 years. They are, of course, the Bali Nine. Here's a picture of them. Really, nine kids. Well, I call them kids. They're about the same age as my kids now. Very sad. And I noticed in the paper, I actually saved the newspaper clipping from 2005 when they were arrested. One of their lawyers said something that caught my eye. Andrea Brown, the lawyer representing Lawrence and Stevens, said the two drug mules were paid a relatively small amount, $10,000 to $15,000, to traffic the heroin, which had a street value of $4 million. She said neither Lawrence nor Stevens, 29, from Taroji near Wollongong, knew that they could face the death penalty until she told them. The lawyer said, quote, "They could die now, can you imagine, for $15,000? And I thought I'd ask her, yep, losing your life for $15,000, bad deal. How much would make it worth it? 10 times that? 150,000? Or 15 million? Or that? There isn't an amount, is there? Jesus says the whole world and lose your life is not worth it. And so I'd ask the middle of nine, at the end of nine reasons, It's worth pausing and thinking, isn't it? What's the direction of our life? Where are we going? What's really important? Are we selling our soul day by day without really realizing it? I'll hand back to Peter.
Thank you, Al. I think by my reckoning we do have a little bit of time left. So do take the opportunity to jot down any comments or questions on a slip of paper.
First one. It seems that the reasons for money not bringing happiness are in verses 10 to 17. That would be, yes, in chapter 2. Are for people who love it, while the blessings of life, verses 18 to 20, are for people who just enjoy the simplicity of life, realise that the blessings are work, food, etc., bring happiness. Yes, I think that's it. I think what he's saying is, if you love money and make that the meaning of life, it'll never deliver, okay? But if you can relax, and instead of trying to own the world, enjoy it and be thankful for what does come from the hand of God, that's the secret. I think that's what he's saying. Yes, I think that's right. Money's not evil at all, but it's seductive. And it keeps kind of whispering in our ears saying, if you just have more of me, life will be better, I'll be happier. And you need more, so you can't give any of me away. And that's right. Spend, save, or sloth. What's better? It's not clear. Does Ecclesiastes mention generosity? Ecclesiastes certainly mentions enjoy life and enjoy your work and so on, and don't invest your life and your meaning in money. But I cannot think off the top of my head where it mentions generosity. 1 Timothy chapter 6 certainly does, okay? The rest of the Bible talks about that all the time. So I'm not sure. Anyone been reading ahead can tell me? Generosity, Ecclesiastes? Yes, very good. And in chapter 11, it talks about cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you'll find it again. Give portions. Thank you. 11:2, well done. Give portions to 7, yes, to 8, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land, etc. 11, later on he says, look, Life can be tough under the sun, and you never know what's going to happen, and it's brief, and it's uncertain, but don't sit in a darkened room. Get out and have a go. And this is part of having a go, and part of having a go is being generous. Yep, thank you. I think 11:2 is what's... invest in lots of things and take a chance. In a world obsessed with superannuation and providing for our future, how do we get a balance on how much wealth is really needed? Very good question. The Bible has lots to say about money. You act responsibly, and actually, if you belong to Jesus, you act responsibly, and you actually trust God rather than your money. You do both, and part of the way that God will provide for you is as you've been careful and wise and saved. That'll be how God will provide for you. But don't put your trust in the money, put your trust in God. It's 1 Timothy chapter 6 is the one to read. And the big test about whether what you're trusting is, can you give money away? Can you actually be generous? Then money's your servant and not your master.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.